So, yesterday we finished talking about the four profundities of the form aggregate. Okay. And so now we're going to go on to the other four aggregates. So the five aggregates comprise all impermanent phenomena. And in general, and in particular, if we talk about the five aggregates of a person, it's talking about our body and our mind. So the body is the form aggregate, and then the feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are part of our mental aggregates. Okay? So, in the text, Avalokiteshvara says, likewise, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Okay, so when we grasp at the inherent existence of feelings, feelings here refer to feelings of pleasant and unpleasant feelings. So it doesn't mean emotions. It means pleasant and unpleasant feelings. So when we grasp at them as inherently existent and think of pleasant feelings as solid things that have a real essence and unpleasant things as solid things with a real essence, then from that, it's very easy to develop attachment to the pleasant ones and aversion to the painful ones. And there we are, set up in attachment and anger again. And karma and the whole wheel goes round. It's quite interesting sometimes when you're feeling an especially pleasant feeling, stop and just ask yourself, why do I call this pleasant? What is pleasant about it? What is pleasurable about this? Or when you have an unpleasant feeling, just stop and say, what is unpleasant about it? What is painful about this? Why do I call this painful? And kind of explore the feeling and see if you can find something inherently in it. That's, you know, some inherent pleasure, some inherent pain. It's quite interesting. Do this when your knees hurt. Yeah? Do this when you eat chocolate. Okay. Then likewise, if we grasp at discriminations as inherently existent, then we get very attached to, you know, how we discriminate and discern phenomena. Okay? And so, for example, the whole thing of border disputes between countries. Yeah, we get attached to the discriminations that we've made. And we've made different discriminations about where the border line is. So this piece of sand is mine, and that, then the other side says, no, it's mine. So again, when we're attached to discriminations, we very easily grasp on to them, and we're back in attachment and anger again. When we grasp at the self, you know, at the compositional factors as inherently existent, then we get very attached to our emotions. And you can see this. Some people are incredibly attached to their emotions. They're attached, they're in love, they feel anguish, they feel jealous, they feel, you know, inspired and full of faith, and their emotions go up and down, and they grasp onto each one of them. It's like the melodrama is so rich and exciting because all these emotions are inherently existent. Okay? So it's very interesting to look sometimes and see if we're attached to our emotions, even the painful ones. Also, when we have this idea of self-existent emotions, you know, because all the emotions fall into this thing of compositional factors, here's where we get the idea, like what you see in psychobabble, that there's like some repressed anger that's always there, you know. So we go around with this idea that there's, you know, even we're happy, we're relaxed, we look at the sky, we feel the wind, there's this repressed anger that's there, the demon in the dungeon, you know, and all I have to do is look at a slug and it's all going to come out. You know, but we have this, we go through, like, you know, our life feeling like there's all these repressed emotions. And that's grasping onto the inherent existence of emotions. You know, because when we have manifest emotions, they're there. But when the emotions aren't manifest, the emotions aren't there. There's the seed of the emotion, the potential for that emotion, but it's not there. It's not like it's under the surface and you're angry all the time, you just don't know it. The seed for the anger is there, but you're not angry all the time. Okay? So it's quite interesting, kind of our psychological model. You know, we always have these self-existent demons. We never think of self-existent angels under the surface, do we? Yeah. I mean, this is kind of our Western pessimism. But this, you know, is because we grasp it at our emotions as self-existent. And it's very interesting, you know, when you're feeling a strong emotion, to just stop and ask yourself, you know, okay, I'm angry. Well, how do I know I'm angry? Why do I call this anger? What is anger about this thing that I'm experiencing? Very interesting to explore, because when you ask yourself this question, you feel, well, okay, there's certain physical sensation, there's a certain kind of mood or flavor in my mind, but there's also all these different moments, and each different moment, it feels slightly different. But on the whole string of all these moments, then I label it anger. But actually, each moment has a slightly different flavor and feeling to it. Yeah? And same thing with attachment. Yeah? You know, we go, oh, I'm so bad, I have so much attachment. Well, what's attachment? You know, is there some solid, inherently existent attachment? Again, when you look, all there are instances of something that we label attachment. But it isn't like there's this pure attachment that all of a sudden is boing there. It's just all we find are examples of attachment. You know, there's attachment to chocolate, and attachment to jewelry, and attachment to clothes, and attachment to bicycles. And there's all these different examples of attachment. And even when we have attachment and we feel the attachment in our mind, it's changing each moment. You know, it's like different instances, different examples of attachment. But it's not like there's one solid thing that's attachment. So it's very interesting. Just sit with this, and, you know, when you're having something, and examine. Yeah? And you'll find different aspects of attachment, and you'll find different moments of attachment. It's not like there's some pure thing there, or pure jealousy, you know, independent of any example or instance of it. So it kind of changes, you know, kind of our model of how we conceive of the personality. Okay? Similarly, when we grasp onto the inherent existence of consciousnesses, okay, so our six consciousnesses, the five sensory ones, and then our mental consciousness that just allow us to perceive things in various ways, you know, then we grasp it at all of our perceptions as being inherently existent. You know, and then that again leads us into attachment, aversion, pride, and jealousy, and the whole thing. Okay? And so here, in the same way that we meditated on the four profundities of form, you meditate on the four profundities of each of these aggregates. Okay? So feeling is empty, feeling is a manifestation of its own emptiness. Feeling and the emptiness of feeling are the same entity, and feeling and the emptiness of feeling are nominally distinct. And so you meditate on each of those, trying to get some kind of feeling for each one. I won't go through and explain it, because you just use the example of form and go through all of these. Okay? So even though explicitly Avalokiteshvara is talking about emptiness here, the emptiness of these different aggregates, he's also implicitly establishing their nominal existence. Because you can't talk about the emptiness of something if it doesn't nominally exist. Okay? So in saying that this is empty and that's empty, he's also saying that these things nominally exist. Okay? And so by understanding the four profundities of each of these five aggregates, we're able to distinguish, inherently existent aggregates from nominally existent ones. And similarly, because the self is based on the five aggregates, this is also, you know, implying that we should meditate on the emptiness of the self and the four profundities in terms of the self. And that helps us also distinguish, you know, the appearance of an inherently existent self, which is a false appearance, from the conventionally existent self that does exist. Now, somebody asked, well, you know, if we perceived only, you know, if we didn't have ignorance, how would the conventionally existent things appear to us? Okay, well, I can't talk from my own experience, but it seems to me that, you know, we would go back to these profundities, and that, you know, if we were perceiving the conventionally existent thing, we would perceive an object as a dependent arising. In other words, that awareness would be very much with us, that this thing exists by appearing, this thing exists by being merely imputed. Yeah, this thing exists as a dependent phenomena. And so you would be seeing that whole dependent nature kind of appearing there together with the object. Okay? So it seems to me that's how it would be. Somebody was also asking, well, who is it that's meditating on emptiness? Okay? It's the conventionally existent self that meditates on emptiness, because that's the only self that exists. Okay? There's no inherently existent self to meditate on emptiness. When, on the path of accumulation and path of preparation, when you meditate on emptiness, there's still the appearance of subject and object, of the meditating mind, and the emptiness that's the object. But once you get to the path of seeing, that appearance of subject and object completely gets lost. Okay? And they say that the mind realizing emptiness and emptiness become inseparable, like water mixed into water. So at the time of path and seeing and above, there isn't this sensation of a separate mind or a separate I that's doing the meditation, because the mind is perceiving its own emptiness. The mind's also perceiving directly the emptiness of inherent existence of the person. Okay? So at that time, there's only the appearance of emptiness. So that actually leads us into the next section. So we just... these letters shrunk again from yesterday. So far we've been talking about how the bodhisattvas meditate on emptiness on the first two of the five paths. Now, when we come to the part here that says, Shariputra, like this, all phenomena are merely empty, having no characteristics. They are not produced and do not cease. They have no defilement and no separation from defilement. They have no decrease and no increase. That paragraph there is talking about how the bodhisattva meditates on emptiness when they're on the path of seeing. So before the path of seeing, you know, there's still the, you know, when you meditate on emptiness, like I said, there's the feeling of a subject and object. There's still, you're perceiving emptiness through a mental image, so it's not a direct perception. But by continuing on meditating like that, you reach a certain point where it becomes a direct perception of emptiness. And that becomes what's called the uninterrupted path of the path of seeing. So an uninterrupted path is the time when you're meditating when you are in the process of abandoning certain disturbing attitudes. It's called uninterrupted because in one meditation session you uninterruptedly abandon that section of disturbing attitudes to be abandoned, and you progress uninterruptedly to what's called the liberated path, which is the mind that has abandoned those specific disturbing attitudes. So remember we were saying on the path of seeing you abandon all the intellectually or artificially generated disturbing attitudes, and this is abandon them once and all from the root. So it's not just that they're not manifest. Before, you know, kind of, you know, they may not be manifest, but the seeds are still there. Now you've removed them, so not even the seeds are there. Okay, so at this point, all dualistic appearance has vanished. Okay, so dualistic appearance has many different definitions according to different philosophical schools and so on. But one here dualistic appearance means the appearance to the mind of an object together with the appearance to the mind of the object's inherent existence. Okay, so the object is appearing together with the object's inherent existence. Okay, so that's dualistic appearance. Okay, so I look at the cup, I look at the flower, everything I see is with dualistic appearance because the object's appearing together with its inherent existence. And this is what existed before the path of seeing. When you get to the path of seeing, then there's absolutely no appearance of inherent existence. And there's no mental image of emptiness. Okay? So you're perceiving emptiness directly. Okay, so all of the minds of sentient beings, except the meditative equipoise of an Arya — an Arya is one who's realized emptiness directly — and meditative equipoise on emptiness is that meditation time when they are focused single-pointedly on the direct perception of emptiness. All other consciousnesses of sentient beings, except that meditative equipoise of emptiness of Aryas, are mistaken consciousnesses. Okay? They're mistaken because inherent existence appears to them. They're mistaken because they have dualistic appearance. Okay? That doesn't necessarily mean they're erroneous or that they're incorrect, because, for example, we can look at the flower and we know it's a flower. That's a valid, conventional cognizer. Now, if we were to try to say it's an inherently existent flower, that wouldn't be perceived by a valid conventional cognizer. But just being able, we're not mistaken or erroneous in identifying this as a flower and this as a cup and this as a thermos. So those are, valid conventional objects, and our mind that perceives them are valid conventional cognizers. Yeah? But in spite of being valid conventional cognizers, they're still mistaken consciousnesses in the sense that all these objects are still appearing to them to be inherently existent. So I think that this is kind of a very strong statement when you think about it, that all minds, even the 10th level bodhisattva, right before they perceive, right before they attain enlightenment, all those consciousnesses also have the very, very slight appearance of inherent existence, and so are still mistaken consciousnesses. It's only the meditative equipoise of the Aryas on emptiness that really perceives things as they are. Otherwise, all of our perceptions, the things we perceive, don't exist in the way they appear to us. Okay? But emptiness, when it's perceived directly, exists in the way it appears. It appears empty and it exists as empty. Okay? That's why it's called an ultimate truth. Okay. With the path of seeing, it abandons the intellectually formed disturbing attitudes, but also doubt is once and for all abandoned, and certain wrong views are once and for all abandoned. Okay, so we were talking about doubt this morning. Look forward to the extinguishment of your doubt eternally on the path of seeing. You'll get there. Okay, now, at the path of seeing, when you come out of your meditative equipoise, then this bodhisattva has all sorts of incredible abilities, and these abilities increase each time, with each bodhisattva bhumi, each bodhisattva stage they go through. So at that time, they can see 100 Buddhas in the shortest instant. They can experience the blessing of 100 Buddhas. They can remain alive for 100 eons and see 100 eons into the past and future. They can absorb into and emerge from 100 different concentrations in an instant. They can vibrate 100 worldly realms by means of magical emanations. And they can experience 100 worldly realms and appear in them. They can ripen 100 beings in an instant by means of their magical emanations. They can go to 100 different Buddha's pure lands in one instant. They can open perfectly 100 different Dharma doors, which means teach different aspects of the Dharma. They can emanate perfectly 100 different bodies from their own body and reveal those to others. And then each of these 100 bodies are endowed with a retinue of 100 bodhisattvas. Okay, so when you get to the first bodhisattva bhumi, for the path of seeing, you get all these abilities, okay? So you've been accumulating all this good karma, you cash it in and get the jackpot. When you get to the second bodhisattva bhumi, yeah, all your interest has compounded interest, so all these things get multiplied. I forget if they're multiplied by 100 or 1,000 or something. But anyways, you go through the 10 bodhisattva stages on the path of seeing and path of meditation. Each of these 12 abilities increases by a certain number of times, simply because the potential of the mind is there to be able to do all that. And once you start eliminating all this garbage, there's just these abilities, you know, because you've eliminated the obstructions. You've spent some time nourishing these seeds in yourself. And so then, of course, you know, all these special abilities just naturally appear because your energy is liberated from just thinking about me and I hurt my toe, you know. There's so much energy there that can be used in so many other ways. Okay, so you really go for it. So then when you're on the path of seeing, the path of seeing still lacks the ability to eliminate the innate disturbing attitudes and their imprints. So you still have to meditate on emptiness and strengthen your meditation on emptiness so that you can get to the path of meditation where you actually begin eliminating the innate disturbing attitudes and their imprints from the root. So what do you meditate on the path of seeing to get there, to deepen your understanding of emptiness, is you meditate on these eight things. So the first one is the nature of phenomena, so saying phenomena are merely empty. Then you meditate on them having no characteristics, on them not being produced and not ceasing. You meditate on them having no defilement and no separation from defilement and no decrease and no increase. So those eight things are what you meditate on in the path of seeing to make your mind ready to get to the path of meditation. So let's look at those eight. So it says, Shariputra, like this, all phenomena are merely empty. So just as the five aggregates that we just got meditating on before are empty, now all phenomena are empty. So this includes all the permanent phenomena like unconstructed, permanent space, like emptiness, like cessations. Okay, these are all permanent phenomena. And so each phenomena, impermanent or permanent, has its own particular nature, which is that it's empty of inherent existence. This is talking about its ultimate nature. So it has its own ultimate nature, its own emptiness, and it also has its own conventional nature. In other words, it nominally exists. Okay, then you meditate on them having no characteristics. So they have, of course they have conventional characteristics, but they don't have inherently existent characteristics. Characteristics here means the features which enable us to distinguish one thing from another thing. Yeah, so it could be tall or short or round or square, or, you know, pleasant or unpleasant or whatever. So all these characteristics are empty of inherent existence, but they exist nominally. Okay? Now the thing is, to the meditative equipoise of the Arya, meditating on emptiness, they don't have they meditate on the emptiness of all these things, and they don't have any appearance of conventional phenomena. Only emptiness appears to their mind. Okay? So they're not all buffeted around by this and that, and I like this and I don't like that, because only emptiness appears to their mind. They don't yet have the ability to perceive the nominally existent object when they're in the middle of meditative equipoise. Only the Buddha has the ability to see the two truths simultaneously. So in this state of meditating on emptiness at the path of seeing, when it says, you know, they have no characteristic, it means, you know, to that meditative equipoise, there's no appearance of conventional phenomena, you know, because the conventional phenomena are, you know, and their characteristics are appearing inherently. So they don't have any appearance of inherent existence. And it's also saying that these phenomena and these characteristics are not inherently existent. Okay? And by saying they're not inherently existent, you know, Avalokiteshvara is applying that they do nominally exist. Okay? Because you can't talk about, you know, say, you can't talk about the emptiness of, you know, the carpet unless the carpet nominally exists. Okay? So he's also establishing the emptiness of the conventional nature of these things. Okay, so then when we say that they're not produced, it means that the production of the phenomena isn't inherently existent, and this implies that phenomena are produced. Okay, so our body, our mind, our happy feelings, our unhappy feelings, all these functional phenomena that depend on causes and conditions, they all are produced depending on causes and conditions, but none of them are inherently produced. Okay? But they are conventionally produced, and their production does exist, okay? But their production exists dependently, exists nominally, okay? So it's very interesting because, you know, sometimes we get this feeling like things are inherently produced. Like, you know, here's a seed and here's a sprout. And, you know, an inherently existent seed and an inherently existent sprout. So, you know, the sprout, which is inherently existent, you know, had an inherently existent production from the seed. You know, and this is the time of its production. But when you look, when was the time of its production? At what moment do you stop calling something a seed and start calling it a sprout? If you took a sprout and a seed and you start to germinate it, and it germinates moment by moment by moment by moment by moment, at what point do you start stop calling it seed and start calling it sprout? It's just, we're all going to have a different moment. It's just a conventional designation, isn't it? We just nominally pick a moment. But it's not like there's some inherent moment of production where, you know, first you had a seed and then whammo bango, all of a sudden you had a sprout. We label production just on this whole process of transformation that's going on. So there's no inherently existent production. Similarly, when we say they do not cease, it similarly means there's no one particular moment where things go out of existence. You know? Now, sometimes it looks like that to us. You know, we drop the glass and it breaks and we say, ugh! You know, so this is an example of gross impermanence. Gross impermanence is where the basis of imputation changes so much that you can no longer call it that object. You have to call it something else. Okay? But still, if we look, you know, at what point did the glass actually break? Yeah? Is it breaking when it's here? Is it breaking the first moment it hits the ground? I mean, because it takes a few moments for this, you know, the vibrations to go and the different cracks to appear. So does it break when the cracks first appear? Does it break when the first piece falls off? Does it break, you know, after all the pieces have fallen off? At what point has it ceased? Again, it's just a nominal distinction that we're making. You know, there's no inherently existent destruction of this thing. Okay? So, and then, so in saying that things do not cease, you know, he's saying that you know, going out of existence is empty, okay, but it conventionally exists. So the gross ceasing of an object, like we drop a cup or like when somebody dies, that conventionally exists. But also it's talking about the subtle ceasing of objects, which is the moment by moment change that they're going through. The fact that our body, for example, every, you know, even shorter than a split second, all the electrons are whizzing around changing positions. You know, our body isn't stationary. All these things are changing moment by moment. So that's subtle impermanence. You know, it's harder for us to recognize that. So in saying things do not cease, it's saying that both the gross and the subtle impermanence are empty, but that they both exist conventionally. And it's a very interesting thing to think about, you know, because we think of death as this one solid thing, don't we? You know, death is like, boy, made of concrete. But what really is death? Yeah? I mean, what really is death? When does death start? When does death end? What really is the moment of death? again, when we talk about death, it's just, you know, there's something that's changing and changing and changing and changing and changing, and after a while it looks really different than it looked before, so we say death happened. But at what point do you really say death occurred? And if you're looking, you know, for a person who died, at what point, you know, what's the person that's dying? Who's the solid person who's dying? You know, when you search for any of these things and try to find them, as you know, with you're searching with an analytical wisdom, all these things, they just kind of, they get very blurry, don't they? You know, at what point do you say it's this is death? And what is death anyway? I mean, isn't death just something we label because something's happened to a phenomena? Death's not a thing on its own right. There's this basis, and all these things are changing, 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 and on top of that, we call it death. Okay? Similar with life, isn't it? Something's happening, changing, changing, changing. Isn't that living? But the same thing we label living, couldn't we also say dying? I mean, dying, when does dying start? Does dying start when you lay down in the bed? You know, does dying start when they stick the tubes in or when they take the tubes out? You know? I mean, actually, aren't we in the process of dying right now? But we're also in the process of living right now. So what really, you know, is there inherently existent living? Is there inherently existent dying? No. Is there some solid, concrete person that's doing all this? You know, when you start looking and analyzing, there's just all these moments of things. And you can't find any solid, concrete thing that goes from one moment to another, like this, you know? All you see is like this overflowing change of stuff that it looks, you know, from one moment it looks similar to the next moment. So therefore we think it's permanent, and therefore we think it has its own essence. But actually, when you look with your wisdom, it's just everything about everything is changing moment by moment. So what is there that's growing old? There's no solid concrete thing that's growing old. Okay? There is nominally existent aging. But you know, and there is a nominally existent person that gets older, but when you search for inherently existent things, they get very blurry. They kind of evaporate under scrutiny. Okay, that's showing that, you know, none of these things can bear, you know, the analysis, the searching for the ultimate. Why? Because they don't ultimately exist. They only exist by being labeled on some kind of basis. So this is very healing for the mind when you start to think about things like this, isn't it? You know, it really heals the mind, makes the mind feel so much better. But there's always an exception. An inherently existent one at that. Okay, so things have no defilement. So again, it's saying that defilement is empty, but defilement also conventionally exists. So defilement means referring to the disturbing attitudes. So being under the influence of uncontrolled birth and death, that's defilement, being under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma. So implicitly, you know, this is saying that defilement exists. And yes, you know, disturbing attitudes exist. Yes, suffering exists. Therefore, we should try and abandon them. But none of these things inherently exist. Okay? Because if they inherently existed, they would be solid. They would have their own essence, which would mean that they're unrelated to other phenomena, which would mean that they couldn't possibly change. Okay. But we can see that our defilements do change, don't they? Yeah? They get they decrease, they increase. They do all sorts of things. They aren't any kind of solid thing. Okay, similarly, there's no separation from defilement. So, okay? So, of course, it's teaching implicitly that it is possible to separate. There's no defilement, there's no separation. Okay, so there's no inherently existent separation from defilement, but of course there is nominally existent separation from defilement, because if we practice the path, we separate our mind from defilement. Okay? Because each disturbing attitude has an antidote, but none of these things inherently exist. Okay? So again, you know, the big mistake people make when they read this and there's no this, no that, is they think Avalokiteshvara is saying nothing exists. But that contradicts our experience, isn't it? Our experience isn't that nothing exists. Our experience is that things exist and things function. Okay? However, they don't exist and function in the way that they appear to us to exist. So Avalokiteshvara isn't saying none of these things exist at all. He's just saying none of them inherently exist. And especially when you're on the path of seeing and perceive things directly, perceive emptiness directly, there's no conventional appearance of any of these things. Okay, so then it goes on, there's no decrease. So phenomena have no inherently existent decrease, but there is nominally existent decrease because we do say somebody's temperature's gone down or the gas tank is emptier or I'm not as angry as I was before. But again, you know, we can't find the moment when all this happened. Yeah? Okay? Similarly, when we say no increase, no, increase exists, but it exists nominally by being merely labeled on a base. There's no inherently existent increase. Okay, so like your bank account going up, is that inherently existent? Yeah? I mean, it's just, it's just penny by penny, isn't it? You know, what is the moment when you collect your interest and it goes up by 4 cents? I mean, there's no inherently existent moment, is there? Yeah? But your bank account does increase. Sometimes. Yeah? Okay? But with anything, you know, where is the moment where something got taller? You know, where is the moment when your child grew? Okay? You know, you say, you know, your child grew from second grade to third grade, but where was the moment that they grew? Is there an inherently existent increase in their height? No. It's just this whole process of change that was going on, and we label that getting taller. Yeah? Okay, so this section here is talking about, it's principally teaching about how phenomena are empty by talking about the nature and the attributes of all these phenomena, these all are empty. Okay, so this is how you practice on the path of seeing. Okay? Path of seeing. Yeah, that's how you meditate on emptiness of the path of seeing. Because you're meditating with a non-conceptual wisdom consciousness that realizes emptiness directly. And so there's no dualistic appearance to this consciousness. There's only the appearance of emptiness. Okay? But again, emptiness doesn't mean non-existence. Okay, so meditating on emptiness, it doesn't mean that the bodhisattva on the path of seeing is spaced out. Okay, meditating on emptiness and spacing out are very, very different. Okay?
So does that mean like in different meditation sessions they take kind of these phenomena?
Mm-hmm.
The phenomena that appears in it is the
emptiness. Yeah. Well, they may start off meditating on the emptiness of one of these things. Yeah, and then perceive it directly. But then it's they also say it's not like you have to go through and do a whole big meditation on each thing. Once you realize the emptiness of one phenomena, simply by switching your mind to the next phenomena, you bring that whole investigative process with you, and like that you realize the emptiness of the next thing. But still, the bodhisattva has to practice over a period of time to deepen their understanding of emptiness. So they're going to do many meditation sessions on emptiness while they're on the path of seeing. Okay, they're also, when they're not meditating on emptiness, they're also going to be practicing the six far-reaching attitudes and accumulating a great deal of positive potential also. Okay, so the positive potential, you know, acts as the support for the deepening of the realization of emptiness. And then they transit to the path of meditation when they enter into a meditation on emptiness that's the uninterrupted path of the path of meditation. That uninterrupted path is the path that has the power to start eliminating the big of the disturbing attitudes and their imprints from the root. Okay? So then we get into this whole thing on the path of meditation, that there's 9 different levels of disturbing attitudes and their imprints, from, you know, big, big, medium, big, small, big, medium, then big, medium, small, medium, 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 small, medium, and then big, small, medium, small, and small, small, okay? So there's, and these are all the same entity of these different disturbing attitudes, but it's just kind of removing like layers of them. So if you remove the big, big first, because that's like the grossest thing, and then the medium big is slightly more subtle, so, you know, you go through. And on the, from the beginning of the path of meditation until the 8th bodhisattva level, which is also on the path of meditation, you're eliminating these 9 different levels of the disturbing attitudes and their imprints. When you've reached the 8th bodhisattva bhumi, or stage, then you are an arhat, because we're talking about the Mahayana path, and you've eliminated all the disturbing attitudes and their imprints completely. You still have these subtle stains or subtle imprints on the mind of the appearance of inherent existence, because even these bodhisattvas who have eliminated the disturbing attitudes and karma, and so thus are never reborn in cyclic existence under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma. You know, although they can be born by the power of their compassion, and they are, because they care about us, so they come back by the power of their compassion. But these bodhisattvas, still, when they're not in meditative equipoise on emptiness, when they're walking around during the day, there's still a very, very slight appearance of inherent existence to their consciousnesses. So they still have to meditate on emptiness to cleanse their mind further and eliminate all the different, you know, stains on the mind. So they eliminate, you know, the gross obstructions to omniscience, the subtle obstructions to omniscience, the extremely subtle obstructions to omniscience. When they do that, when they've eliminated all of that, then they get to the 5th path, the path of no more learning. Okay? So now, actually, we're going to, Avalokiteshvara goes on and talks about how you practice the perfection of wisdom on the path of meditation. Okay? So that is this whole section that starts, therefore, Shariputra in emptiness. There is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no composition. That whole paragraph down to no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. So that's how you practice on the path of meditation. Okay? So in saying that each one of these things is empty, because when he says there's no this, there's no that, what he means is there's no inherently existent this, there's no inherently existent that. In saying that they're inherently existent, that's, he's explicitly teaching emptiness, but implicitly he's, you know, establishing these things as nominally existent. Okay? So here comes like an explanation of all these things, you know, what they are in terms of conventional reality, so that we can see that they conventionally exist, but we can also see that they're empty. So I think this is quite interesting, because in going through all these lists and naming these things, what Avalokiteshvara is also emphasizing is that it's very important to have conventional wisdom and to be able to distinguish one phenomena from another in a conventional level. That meditating on emptiness doesn't mean when you're outside your meditation session that everything, because it's empty, just becomes mush. Okay? And, I mean, this is the view of many, you know, people who know the words about emptiness but have never studied it or practiced it, because they go through saying, well, there's no good and there's no bad, so there's no good karma and there's no bad karma, so it doesn't matter what you do because it's all empty. You know, when somebody talks like that, it shows they have no understanding of emptiness. They also have no understanding of conventional truth. So their minds are really out of whack. Okay? Because in saying that things are empty, you're talking about conventionally existent phenomena. So you have to understand what these conventionally existent phenomena are in order to understand, you know, kind of understanding their emptiness helps you understand it, what they are. And your acuity and your ability to discriminate things on a conventional level increases. You know, that's your wisdom, your conventional wisdom becomes incredibly sharp. So it's not that things get all blurry and bodhisattvas are these space cases, okay? Because definitely in order to help sentient beings, you have to have a lot of conventional wisdom and be able to discriminate things. But while you're discriminating things, you're not, you know, seeing them as inherently existent stuff. Okay, so you're not saying there's inherently existent good and there's inherently existent evil. Okay, you know, because that's just grasping an inherently inherent existence. That doesn't exist. Some kind of concrete good, some kind of concrete evil, concrete good karma, concrete bad karma. Those things don't exist. The, you know, good karma, bad karma are empty of inherent existence. They're merely labeled on a whole process of different things, and they're labeled in terms of the results that they bring. Something's only called positive because it brings the result of happiness. That's the only reason it's called positive. It's not inherently positive from its own side. And similarly, a negative action becomes negative only because, you know, in the karmic view of things, it produces suffering. If that same action didn't produce suffering but produced happiness, it would be called positive. So it's not like negative karmas from their own side have this inherent negative thing in it, you know. And you can see how our grasping at inherent existence of positive and negative karma, that's what makes us feel guilty and what makes us feel arrogant. Okay? But when we recognize that these things exist only nominally, it makes our mind feel a lot lighter about the whole thing. But also, because we see that they do exist nominally and that that means they do function, then we definitely take more care about our karma, you know? Because we see that because the karma is empty, it functions. Well, if it functions, then I want to create good causes and avoid bad causes. Okay? So actually, the more, if you have a correct understanding of emptiness, it increases your attentiveness to the functioning of karma. Okay? It doesn't make everything mush. Contrary to what you read on in some of the New Age press. Excuse me. That's how New Age press is only merely labeled. My opinions are only merely labeled. But the Buddha agrees with my opinions, so they're right. What I'm trying to do is make my opinions agree with the Buddha's opinions, actually. I'd be much better off if I did that. Okay, so here we're starting off. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no composition, no factors, no consciousness. So those are the five aggregates that comprise all impermanent phenomena. So we're saying those are all empty. Okay? There is no eye, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no tactile object, no phenomena. These 12 are called the 12 sources because they are the sources from which consciousnesses arise. Okay? So you have the eye sense power, which connects with form and produces a visual consciousness. Okay? You have the ear sense power, which enables us to connect with sound and produce an auditory consciousness. So these 12 actually include all phenomena, permanent and impermanent ones. So the permanent ones, when it says no phenomena, it means everything, all the other things besides form, sound, smell, taste, and touch. Tactile objects, okay? All the other phenomena that appear to only mental consciousnesses, they're included in that thing where it says no phenomena, okay? And where it says no mind, that includes all the six kinds of consciousnesses. So, you know, these things, they're the six, the 12 sources, the 12 keche is the Tibetan. So those are all empty. The reason they go through all these lists is when you meditate on all these different things, and we don't really have the time to go through and define each one, when you meditate on these, you get really this feeling of the diversity of phenomena and the diversity of things upon which, the diversity of basis of imputations upon which things are labeled. Okay? So as you begin to see this vast diversity of things, and that other things, you know, one phenomena is merely labeled on another, but that's merely labeled on another, and that's merely labeled on another base, you know. In other words, like, body is labeled on all these parts of the body, but the parts of the body, the hand is also labeled on the collection of fingers and palm, but the fingers are also merely labeled on something else, you know? And so you see that all these things are merely labeled. As you do that, it gives you, it really enhances the understanding of emptiness, because you see that all these things are empty and that all these things are act as basis of imputation to establish the existence of other nominal, nominally existent phenomena. And this all, this helps very much also in understanding the emptiness of the self, because what we call I is, you know, based on all these consciousnesses perceiving all these different objects by the power of, you know, the different sense powers that we have. So you begin to say that what we call self, you know, is labeled on a lot of these different phenomena too. So that helps to get a better understanding of the emptiness of inherent existence of a person. So need to go a little bit quicker, excuse me. Okay, there is no I element and so forth, up to no mind element, and also up to no element of mental consciousness. So these are called the 18 sources. Okay, if you take the 12, I mean, not the 18 sources, the 18 elements. If you take the 12 sources and expand them, you get the 18 elements. So six of them become sense powers, yeah, that are the thing that help connect the object to the, and generate the consciousness. Six of them are consciousnesses, and six of them are the objects of consciousnesses. So those, that whole thing are the 18 elements. Okay, so that's what's included in that sentence. So we don't really have time to go through with the whole list, but you can look it up. It's better than me reading it to you, isn't it? Okay, there's no ignorance and no exhaustion of ignorance and so forth, up to no aging and death and no exhaustion of aging and death. Okay, so this is talking about the 12 links of dependent origination, you know, which we've been mentioning off and on. The first link is ignorance. Through ignorance, you know, then the ignorance that is the root of samsara, the grasping and inherent existence, then we create karma, which is the second link, which puts an imprint on consciousness, which is the third link. Okay, those three are often called projecting causes, because they project us into another rebirth. Okay, then you have name and form, which are so called because they act as the basis for calling, naming a person. So this is, you know, the name and form is like when the consciousness enters into the sperm and egg, and you have the new life. Then you have the six sense sources developing. Then you have feeling. Then you have contact, because your six sense powers contact objects, so you have contact. Then you have feeling, pleasant, unpleasant feeling. Okay? So those. Okay, the fourth one is name and form. Fifth is sense powers. Thank you. Somebody remembers. Sixth is contact. Seventh is feeling. Those are often called the projected effects, okay, because they're projected by the causes. Then you get craving, grasping, and becoming. We were talking about these before. So craving is the eighth link, when you're craving to hang on to this life and this body. Grasping is when you realize you can't do that anymore, so you grasp at the next one. This all happens at the time of death. Then that makes the karmic seed ripen. So the intention, that karmic seed, you know, that karma ripening, is the tenth link of becoming. So those are often called the actualizing causes, because they help actualize the karma that was planted previously. And then they lead to the actualized results, which are the 11th and 12th link. The 11th one is birth. So there you are in another body. And the 12th one is aging and death. And while you're in, you know, birth and aging and death, then you start creating more and more series of 12 links, because while you're in that stage, living your life, you have ignorance, which creates action, which creates, puts more karma on the consciousness. Okay? And we go through our life creating many sets of you know, ignorance and action and conscious ignorance, all the time we're acting. We're creating these first three links again and again. Then at the end of each life, we have the craving, grasping, and becoming, and then that throws us into another life where we get all the results. So actually the 12 links, this is a very, very cursory explanation of the 12 links. It takes a long time to explain them properly because there's a way of explaining them over two lives, a way of explaining them over three lives. So, but what it's doing is it's emphasizing that because the 12 links talk about how you get born in samsara, how cyclic existence occurs, how it continues. So in saying that there's no ignorance up to no aging and death, it's saying that this whole process of taking rebirth and cyclic existence is empty of inherent existence. Okay? So all these steps, all of cyclic existence, completely empty of inherent existence. It's a completely dependently related process that's going on. And so all these different links are merely labeled on different bases. That's all. You know, and cyclic existence is merely labeled on the basis of all these 12 links happening. So we talk of the 12 links, on the side of disturbing attitudes, the deluded 12 links. So that's where we talk about ignorance, from it going from ignorance to aging and death, and talking about how we get born in cyclic existence again and again. Then there's also a way of talking about the 12 links on the side of purification. And that's where we're talking about no ignorance, because in that sentence, you know, no exhaustion of ignorance, okay, up to no exhaustion of aging and death, because this talks about how we liberate ourselves from cyclic existence. So if you cease ignorance, then you can't create karma anymore, so the link of karma stops. If you don't create karma, then you don't have the consciousness upon which the karmic seeds are planted anymore. So that stops. It doesn't mean consciousness in general stops. It just means the consciousness that upon which, you know, samsaric seeds for rebirth and samsara are planted. That stops. Okay? Then from that, then, you know, name and form and cyclic existence stops. Then you don't get the six sense bases in cyclic existence. Then, you know, the feeling gets exhausted and stops. Then, or the contact stops. Then the feeling stops. Okay? So it, again, what it's talking about here, all these things, like the feeling, it doesn't mean that all feelings stop when you realize emptiness, okay? But what it means is that all the feelings that are involved in cyclic existence stop, okay? So all the feelings of pain and pleasure that are conditioned by our, you know, all of our ignorance and karma and all this thing, all that gets stopped. The Buddha still has pleasurable feelings, okay? That still exists. Similarly, when we say consciousness stops, it doesn't mean all consciousness stops. Okay, when you go through the 12 links, no ignorance, no this, no that, okay? It's just meaning that these things that are involved in the 12 links. Similarly, you know, we say no, you know, birth stops. It means birth and cyclic existence under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma. Bodhisattvas can still, by the power of their compassion, choose to be reborn. Okay? This whole, when we talk about the 12 links on the side of purity or the side of purification, the exhaustion of ignorance leads to the exhaustion of karma, leads to the exhaustion of consciousness, up to the exhaustion of aging and death, then also that whole process is not inherently existent. So that's also meant in that sentence when they're saying that. No exhaustion of ignorance, up to no exhaustion of aging and death, that all that is dependently arising also. It's not inherently existent. And I mean, I think this is really profound because, you know, we were talking about it the other day, how as you meditate on emptiness, it's like, well, you get a feeling of emptiness about this, but then the mind says, but this must be inherently existent, you know? And then you meditate on the emptiness of that, and then the mind jumps to something else and says, oh, but that must be inherently existent. Okay? And so that's why Avalokiteshvara is going through all these things here, because it just keeps cutting away, because no phenomena is inherently existent. Yeah, emptiness is not inherently existent. Buddha isn't inherently existent. Dharma isn't inherently existent. Neither is Sangha. Nothing is inherently existent. Okay? So it just keeps cutting and cutting away at our mind, looking for something, you know, to hold on to, even though it's painful. Okay, so Then, when it goes on, Avalokiteshvara goes on and he says, likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path. That's the Four Noble Truths. Okay? So also the Four Noble Truths are not inherently existent. So here, actually, it'd be so nice if we had time, you know, kind of go into the Four Noble Truths a little bit more in depth. Yeah? But none of them are inherently existent either. So, you know, all the true sufferings, all the things in cyclic existence, our body, our feelings, all these things aren't inherently existent. The causes, all the karmic seeds, all the karmic actions, all the disturbing attitudes, these aren't inherently existent. Okay? True cessation, which is the emptiness of a mind that has eliminated a portion of the disturbing attitudes and their imprints forever, that also isn't inherently existent. It's merely labeled. The path, the wisdom realizing emptiness, also is something that exists by being merely labeled on a basis of imputation. Okay? So all these things, four noble truths, merely labeled. Okay? Of the Four Noble Truths, suffering, origin, and path are impermanent phenomena. True cessations are permanent. True cessations are emptinesses. Okay? They're not all emptinesses are true cessations, but the emptiness of a mind which has removed, you know, any portion of disturbing attitudes and their imprints from the root, you know, that is a true cessation. That, okay, the emptiness of that mind. Okay? So true cessations are emptinesses. They're ultimate truths. All the rest are conventional truths. But all of them exist conventionally. None of them exist ultimately. Okay? Then Avalokiteshvara goes on. No exalted wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. Because here, you know, we're clutching on to, but the wisdom realizing emptiness has to be inherently existent. And the attainment of Buddhahood has to be inherently existent. And he's saying, sorry, folks, no. Yeah? None of that is inherently existent. Okay? So when we say exalted wisdom, it's referring to the exalted wisdom realizing emptiness of an Arya, of a being on the path of seeing or above. So it shows that that wisdom realizing emptiness is empty. When it talks about attainment refers to wholesome qualities that are attained or developed through practicing the spiritual paths. So these can refer to good qualities, good results, let's say, like upper rebirths, or it could refer to, you know, those are called kind of temporal things, or it could refer to what we call definitive goodness, like the attainment of liberation and enlightenment, the 10 powers of a Buddha, the 4 fearlessnesses of a Buddha, the 32 qualities, the 32 signs and the 80 marks of a Buddha's body, the 60 melodious ways of speech of a Buddha's speech, yeah, the 18 unique features of a Buddha, all of a Buddha's mind, all these things are attainments, so none of them are inherently existent either. Okay? They all arise depending on causes and conditions. They all arise depending on parts and a basis of imputation. They all exist because of a conceptual mind connecting the dots and giving it a name. Okay? So, I mean, this prevents us from grasping onto spiritual attainment. You know, because one part of our mind says, I want to become Buddha. I'm going to become an inherently existent Buddha. You know, well, Buddha's not inherently existent, you know. I mean, all this grasping we have onto spiritual attainment. Yeah, I want to realize emptiness. I want to develop bodhicitta. Like, bodhicitta is this solid, concrete thing. Yeah, again, bodhicitta is just labeled on any moment of a primary consciousness that has the two aspirations. One is to benefit sentient beings and the other is to become a Buddha in order to do that most effectively. Bodhicitta is merely labeled on the basis of that. There's no solid bodhicitta anywhere. Okay? So any of the spiritual attainments, when you look at them, there's nothing there to grasp at. They're all merely labeled on different bases. Because if they were existed inherently, they would have their own nature, which would mean they would be independent, which would mean if they're independent, then they're independent from causes and conditions, which would mean that you can't even generate them because they're permanent. Okay? So they can't have some solid essence that makes them what they are in an ultimate way, because then they would be impossible to generate. And they couldn't even function. Okay? Because a bodhisattva's bodhicitta has to change moment by moment, doesn't it? You know? It changes as a bodhisattva is doing different actions. Their bodhicitta moment by moment is changing. It doesn't decline, you know, but it kind of how it's used, it changes moment by moment. So in order, the fact that these things function shows that they're empty. Okay? So just if we come back to our own experience, the fact, because in our experience things function, don't they? They function, they produce results. The fact that they function proves that they're not inherently existent, because in order to function, you have to change. And in order to function, it means you're influenced by causes and conditions. Okay? So for all of that to happen, things have to be dependent. To change, you have to be dependent on causes and conditions. So therefore, they're not inherently existent. Yeah? So if we just come back to our experience of things functioning, the functioning proves that they're empty. Yeah? Because inherently existent things couldn't function. Okay, so when we're saying no non-attainment, okay, so the no non-attainment refers to things that are to be abandoned, like cyclic existence, suffering, disturbing attitudes, all these things. So also, all those things that we want to abandon, those things don't exist inherently either. Okay? So our suffering does not inherently exist. Okay? Sit with that one for a while. Okay? Our disturbing attitudes don't inherently exist. Yeah, all these horrible feelings we have don't inherently exist. Our moods don't inherently exist. I mean, look at our moods. When we're in the middle of having a certain mood, our mood feels like that's all there is in the whole world. You know, and it seems like this solid thing that just kind of came out of nowhere, and it has this essence of being a horrible mood. And of course we feel like it's totally unchangeable. We feel like it's independent, don't we? It's totally independent. Nothing produced it. And also because it's independent, we can't get out of it. We are stuck in this horrible mood forever and ever. You know? That's the way we view our bad moods. Is that how they exist? Are our bad moods concrete? I mean, what's our own experience? Our bad moods change, don't they? And if you look close enough, they change moment to moment. And if you continue looking closely, you can see that your bad mood had causes and conditions. Not just one cause, not just two causes, but a whole bunch of them and a whole bunch of conditions. And you also see that there was no one moment where your bad mood started. Yeah, you can't find the production of your bad mood in that one moment. You know, and if you look, your bad mood, you know, what you call bad mood is just this whole sequence of moments. Okay. Sometimes what's very interesting is you have a bad mood, sometimes you lose your samadhi on your bad mood. And you actually, you know, smile at somebody. And then you correct your fault and go back immediately to having the bad mood. But we still label that whole thing bad mood, even though we lost it and smiled at somebody. In order not to admit that there's any, you know, because we can't admit there's any happiness in our life when we're in a bad mood. So we label bad mood, I was in a bad mood all day, you know. So we completely discount all the moments we smiled, okay? We even label them bad mood. We make them inherently exist. I mean, huh? So when you look, you know, I mean, where's this bad mood that we think is there? Yeah, it's just a label that we're putting on a bunch of different moments, isn't it? Okay, so think about that next time you're in a bad mood. like now. Because we're late for dinner, so you must be in a bad mood. Okay. So, what all this is emphasizing is this is how the Bodhisattva on the path of meditation meditates on emptiness, seeing everything is empty, and yet at the same time is able to establish on a conventional level the nominally existent phenomena that function. Okay? So we'll say the mantra, and then we'll dedicate. And it's very interesting, you know, when you read the prayers sometime, read the prayers with an awareness that every word that you're saying is a label on a basis. You know, due to this merit, you know. Merit is just a label on a basis. Yeah? May I attain the state of Aryatara. The state of Aryatara is just a label on a basis. Okay, sentient beings that we're trying to eliminate exist by being merely labeled on various bases. No, it's that we're trying to enlighten. Okay? Okay? So, you know, it's very interesting. You know, and when you dedicate, you know, you also focus on, you know, the I that's doing the dedication, you know, is empty. And the positive potential that we're dedicating is empty. And the enlightenment we're dedicating it to is empty. And the sentient beings who we're doing this for are empty. You know? Or you could also do it, and you know, you can do that concentrating on them being empty. You can also dedicate by saying, you know, the I that's dedicating is merely labeled. And the positive potential, the merit, is merely labeled. The sentient beings are merely labeled. The enlightenment is merely labeled. So, you know, when you're doing the prayers, you know, or even at the end or even at the beginning of your session when you're taking refuge, you can focus on emptiness. And as you're saying each thing, you know, recognize that it's merely labeled on a base, therefore it's empty. Or it's empty, therefore it's merely labeled on a base. Okay.